Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 274. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. I am being joined today by another one of our FDH Lounge dignitaries, a longtime member of the dignitaries. We are moving through a series in terms of looking at the top players in every sport. This is a list that we've been doing at FDH the last couple of summers, and we are expanding this year to include it as show segments. You will see this list as it has been the last couple of summers in our upcoming Pro Hoops Draftology Guide. In the case of this year, of course, Pro Hoops Draftology 2013, a production of FantasyDraftHelp.com, the FDH Lounge, Sportsology, and many other good folks in 21st Century Media Alliance. So the critique that we're going to be getting of this list today is going to be coming from, as I say, good friend of ours, longtime member also of the 21st Century Media Alliance. This is a gentleman who has had a previous association with NBC Sports, doing some sports casting in a local market, also working as a blogger for NBC Sports. He is now, for the purposes of today, this is what's most relevant, the managing editor at that NBALotteryPick.com, the web's premier site for the intersection of hoops and pop culture. He's going to be telling us what he likes and doesn't like about this list, my good friend, Ben Hsu. Ben, how you doing today, my friend?
I'm doing good, Rick. How you been?
Oh, doing fine, buddy. Appreciate you joining us here today from your home base in Portland. The way to do this here, as we've been doing for our recent segments for MLB and for NHL, let's start by taking a look at the guys that dropped off of the list from last year, and I'll indicate where they were. Those guys, Andrew Bynum, he was 16th last year, Amari Stoudemire, 18th, Steve Nash, 22nd, Al Jefferson, 23rd, Monte Ellis, 24th, Josh Smith, 26th, Joe Johnson, 28th. Outside of maybe Monte Ellis, Josh Smith, maybe Joe Johnson, no real surprises in there, but they were more towards the lower end of the list. You certainly couldn't quibble with dropping Andrew Bynum off it altogether since he didn't play a game between the time we rated him last year and when we're rating him now. So anything that comes to mind as far as the guys who dropped off of the list?
I mean, in terms of the guys who dropped off the list, it's mainly one of the issues, especially when you do a top 30 or a top 40 in regards to any professional sport, is that some guys have bad years, some players don't play, and you have to deal with the issues of how you rank certain guys at certain times. And at this point, I didn't have any real personal arguments about anyone you left off the list.
Okay. All right, well, that's good. And as far as the placement of guys where we have them on the list, we'll see if that holds or how much that holds. In terms of looking at the fifth tier, we'll count our way up from 30. By the way, the reason that we're using 30, and we're going to be using 32 on our upcoming NFL one that we do, very, very simple. Just an average of one player per team. You figure if there's an even distribution of one great superstar per team, which, of course, there's not, this is how it would come out. So in terms of how the list shakes out, I'll give you where they're at this year, where they were at last year, if that applies, and we'll just take a look at it at the end of every tier. We move from 30 to 20. That's our fifth tier. We start with Rudy Gay, 30th. He was 19th last year. 29th, Rajon Rondo. He was 25th a year ago. Marc Gasol at 28th place. He joins the list for the first time. Darren Williams, 27th place, down from 14th. One of the guys really plummeting this year. DeMarcus Cousins, 26th. He was 20th last year. Zach Randolph, 25th, down from 21st a year ago. Damian Lillard, a guy that I know you know something about, Ben, 24th, obviously for the first time on the list. John Wall, 23rd. It is his first time on the list as well. David Lee, 22nd, down from 13th a year ago. 21st place, Paul George, his first time on the list. And in 20th place, off the list a year ago, but not his first time on the list, Tim Duncan, with a great comeback season in terms of what he represented to his team. So your thoughts on any of the guys on the fifth tier, Ben?
I mean, and overall, in terms of the fifth tier, you have guys who are going to rise, like Paul George, Willard, and, you know, you can make an argument for Cousins, and you can even still make an argument for Rudy Gay. Overall, though, I think in terms of how it shook down in the fifth tier, there's not really a huge argument against anyone right now. I think David Lee's a little too high at 22nd, but Okay. Mainly that's because of a byproduct, I think, of the Golden State offense. But that's not a knock on David Lee. David Lee has always been a good player, especially with his times with the Knicks. But just judging on the fifth tier, I have a sinking suspicion regarding, especially with Paul George, that he's going to make that leap to the fourth or third tier really soon. But at this general period of time, I don't really see anyone that I would be completely irritated with at this point in terms of where they were placed on the list.
Well, it's very funny you mentioned Paul George and you mentioned David Lee, because when I did my preliminary mock-up of the list in early May, I certainly took subsequent things they did in the playoffs into account. So Paul George ended up moving up some spots. Mm-hmm. David Lee ended up moving down some spots. He was 13th a year ago, 22nd now, but he would have been probably a little closer to 13 than 22 before the playoffs. And when you look at it may or may not be completely his fault, but how well Golden State ran in his absence. And also looking at this tier, the guy that plummeted the most on it, Deron Williams, I think you and I can both agree, going to 27th from 14th. We owe a big, you mad, bro, to Deron Williams.
Well, I mean, in regards to Deron Williams, he had a solid season this year for the Brooklyn Nets. But this is what ends up happening, especially with a lot of these big three teams in the NBA right now. When you have those three stars, you have to defer. He's not going to have the same years he had in Utah. So, you know, at some period of time, I can understand. You could make an argument for guys like, you know, you could make an argument for Josh Smith or Monte Ellis or even Joe Johnson to replace Deron Williams on the list. But especially in terms of the best point guards in the NBA, if you were to make a list just of that, it would be really hard not to put D. Will at least in the top five.
Yeah, he's certainly going to be at least at the periphery of that discussion. I think there's no question about it. The third tier and the fourth tier also have a number of names on it. I think this is where we're going to find the greatest amount of intrigue as we go through the next two ones. The fourth tier goes from 19 up to 12. We start with Chris Bosh at 19, 15th a year ago. Dirk Nowitzki, 18th. He was 7th a year ago. He kind of took a hit on the list this year. Conversely, Paul Pierce, 17, he was 27th a year ago. So he kind of went the other way as Dirk Nowitzki, meeting him in about the same spot. In 16th place, Blake Griffin, down from 9th last year. 15th, Kyrie Irving, up from 30th a year ago. He had just barely made the list. 14th, Tony Parker, again, up from 29th a year ago, a tremendous climb on his part. LaMarcus Aldridge, 13, up from 17th a year ago. And Dwight Howard, 12th. Down narrowly from 10th a year ago. A lot of big names on that list, Ben. A lot of guys who at one point in time have been referred to as franchise players, some like Kyrie Irving, that are thought to be growing into that right now. Again, I think just a lot of intrigue looking at the guys from 12 to 19 on this list.
I think, to be fair, and I know I'd probably say this already, it's a lot of interchangeable names and faces. Like, there is an argument to be made for some guys in the fifth tier to go to the fourth tier. And there are arguments for some of the players in the third tier to drop all the way to the fourth tier. Overall, though, I find it very interesting that, especially in this portion of the list, there are a lot of big men. You have Howard, you have Aldridge, you have Griffin, you have, you know, you could say Chris Bosh, you know, he is 7 foot, but sometimes, you know, the argument goes he doesn't play up to his 7 feet potential, and you still have Dirk Nowitzki. Overall, I don't have any real major arguments with the fourth tier, but for me, I would put Blake Griffin a little bit ahead of Kyrie Irving and maybe a little bit ahead of LaMarcus Aldridge if we're just basing it on the totality of the potential that he displayed through this season. But
okay,
again, it's a weird argument, because if I was looking at this list ahead of time and you told me that, you know, an off-injured Dwight Howard this season would be better than LaMarcus Aldridge or Blake Griffin. I mean, there are many arguments that you can make that Howard probably shouldn't even been in the fourth tier, at least for this season.
Well, that's very true. If you're looking at it purely on what he did last year, and that's why, again, this is a snapshot in time. It's what they did mm-hmm. over the past year. It's what they've done previously. It's what we're expecting next year. It's an interesting kind of blend, and it's what allows us to look at it different ways. So clearly with what you said about Blake Griffin, then, so you're not somebody that subscribes to the notion that there is some disturbing softness that's coming out in his game. I mean, his rebounding totals have not gone in the direction that a lot of people thought.
Right, I agree with that, but I think the notion of the fact of his rebounding numbers being low, it's not necessarily apparent to him being soft, but it's more apparent to the game that the current NBA is. And if you look down the statistics of the guys who had big, you know, rebounding seasons, they're nowhere near some of the numbers that were coming down in the 80s and the 90s. It's just a completely different game at this point. And if we're judging on the top 30 itself, I would put Griffin just a little bit higher just because of his notoriety. And in terms of if you were to start a team today, I would prefer to have a player of Blake Griffin's caliber over a guy like LaMarcus Aldridge or Dwight Howard.
Okay. That's an interesting point. A name that I didn't hear you critique where I had him on the list here, so I don't know if this means you agree with me or not. It felt a little harsh taking Dirk Nowitzki, moving him from 7 a year ago down to 18. I thought that was kind of what the numbers bore out. I'm certainly not saying that the guy's hit the wall in terms of his career numbers, but having him as close on the list as he is to Tim Duncan, who, again, people are very happy with what he did this past year, but everybody looks at Tim Duncan and says he's great, but he's not what he used to be. He's in that phase of his career. Is Dirk moving towards that? Do you think that's what's moving him from 7 to 18 sort of suggests, or is it a little premature to come to that conclusion?
I would think so, Rick. I think overall, Nowitzki is still a star. He's still a talented player. He'll probably make another couple All-Star teams before his career ends. But in his defense, when you win the NBA Finals and you have a couple of subpar seasons after that, you're always mm-hmm. going to fluctuate downwards. And to be fair to him, the talent that he currently has around him is probably not what it should be based on the Dallas media market and Mark Cuban and all these other factors. But in him dropping those 11 spots, I don't really think that's really antithesis on Dirk, but it's just more about how his team is currently doing.
Yeah, and the point about the surrounding cast is very well taken. I mean, he had 1 month of the mirage of O.J. Mayo looking like the guy we thought he'd be when he was in high school. And then, the surrounding cast that he had in Big D was not nearly what he was used to having around him. The third year
– mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead, buddy.
No. I think overall, though, in terms of the fourth tier, I still think – I know Kyrie and Tony Parker are on 14th and the 15th spot, but there's an argument to be made that they should be placed higher than some of the big men because in terms of pure point guards – yeah, I think that's more of an important thing to have in today's NBA in comparison to having a good big man. Big men, I know people have been saying that, what happened to all the big men? Well, it's the game that we currently play in. So I would personally value a starting point guard over a big man in this realm of today's NBA.
And I hear you on that, but I have to say, and again, as a lifelong Cavs fan, I don't have any misgivings about Kyrie Irving whatsoever. Aside from something that's out of his control, and that being that if San Antonio is able to buck the odds here and somehow win this final series that they are still enmeshed in right now, they would be the first team in a long time. You probably got to go back to the Magic Lakers. We don't see teams where the best player is a point guard that wins championships. We haven't seen that in some time, and I don't know if that's just a coincidence. That it always seems to be a wingman, or in the case of Tim Duncan, a big man, or Shaq when he was the best player on some of his championship-winning teams. I don't know what that is, but that factor is out there. And I confess that I don't know what to make of it.
Right, and there's also the argument that you can even have regarding, well, were those great Spurs teams Tim Duncan's teams, or were they Tony Parker's team? Because there are times that you can look at the numbers and say, well, Duncan had better numbers, but if you would go through some of those finals, Parker was the more dominant player.
Well, that's true. That's true. And you go back to 07 where I was just screaming my head off for somebody to stick out an elbow every time Parker was coming down the lane, and it never happened. So you have a very good point there. But, you know, I don't like to look back. I don't like to second guess. But the fact that I had Parker on this thing 29th a year ago, he's 14th now. Yeah, some of it is he had a better year this year than last year, but some of it feels, you know, looking back, like I probably shouldn't have had him as low as 29 a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, and to be in Parker's defense, he didn't have a good season last year. And I think a lot of people have, you know, decided to underrate him a little bit in terms of how this season went. And I think we all started to get back to the wise, you know, Tony Parker of old during this playoff run for San Antonio. So I think then it was very possible we are prisoners of the moment, but Tony Parker has just been such a great player. And considering he was a late first-round draft pick, it's sort of ridiculous to think that someone of his caliber and his talent, it took, you know, the 29th or 30th team to figure that pick out at that point.
Absolutely. What I always compare it to, as a hockey fan, I've been fortunate that my Detroit Red Wings have had kind of the same thing going as far as guys from overseas. Pavel Datsyuk, Henrik Zetterberg, et cetera, guys who were not early-round picks, but guys who were mid-round picks and who were products of the European scouting system. San Antonio tends to work the same way. I was joking about that when the Cavs hired Danny Ferry as the GM, years back, I was hopeful that the last thing that he did was, take out a camera, go through their files, and basically, spend the entire night before he left taking pictures of all of the records there. Unfortunately, the tenure in Cleveland proves that that was not the case, but that's how that San Antonio organization operates on down the line. I mean, we can find faults in the game right now with Thiago Splitter and some of these other guys, but time and time again, and it's not just the overseas guys, it's reclamation projects in the States, like Danny Green and Gary Neal. But one way or another, they always tend to find guys like Tony Parker. He's probably the most spectacular example of it, him and Manu Ginobili. But still, hats off to Pop and to everybody in that organization for what they've been able to do. R.C. Buford, that is the premier example of being able to find talent anywhere in the game of basketball, Ben.
Right, and I think Buford is one of the – arguably, you can make the argument outside of only a couple guys that he is the best GM that the NBA has ever seen. And I think – the important part we have to know is that specifically with the Spurs is that it wasn't drafting international players wasn't the first thing, but they were the first organization to go out there and scout in different areas. When most of the NBA was looking into the high school generation kids, they were looking out. So it's always the first person that sets the trend that really determines how, you know, the league progresses. And at this time, I find it, you know, even with Parker and Duncan retiring in the near future, they still have a really good young core of a lot of good young players that they can probably at least compete for a playoff berth for at least the next 5 to 6 years.
Absolutely, yeah. You cannot bet against them with the system that they've had in place there. When we look at the guys on the fourth tier, it's all guys that are on the cusp, I think, guys who could jump up again, guys like Dwight Howard who were a tier or two higher earlier, guys like Kyrie Irving and possibly LaMarcus Aldridge, who still have the ability to go up another tier from where they're at. In the case of Blake Griffin, you made the case that he should already be regarded higher than that. This third tier, you got a lot of question marks here. You got guys who can deliver a championship to your team, particularly if they're surrounded by the right parts, but a lot of question marks, particularly injuries right now, and that's what leads to a guy at the top of the third tier that I find shocking. I find it shocking, and I'm the guy that made the list out, but I could not come to any conclusion other than the one that I did. So here's what we got. Russell Westbrook is 11th. He was 11th a year ago. Questions still surrounding his game as far as the shoot-first mentality. He's injured right now, but he is so insanely talented. You can't have him any lower than 11th, and I would argue you can't have him lower than 3rd tier. In 10th place, not on the list a year ago, Stephon Curry, he had the tremendous playoff series there for Golden State this year, the tremendous run that he had in the postseason that really kind of cemented his status upwards. 9th place, Kevin Love, down from 4th a year ago, another guy that had an injury-plagued and disappointing season. Speaking of which, Kobe Bryant, 8th place, down from 3rd a year ago. I think we pretty much all know his story. 7th place, He was eighth a year ago. Chris Paul, I have him right about where he was. Sixth place, again, a guy that didn't play a game, but if you're starting a team right now, Derrick Rose, a guy that even as far back as the playoffs, arguably was fully healed. We have yet to see him on an NBA court, although he's been playing on a lot of practice courts recently. Fifth place at the top of the third tier, not on the list a year ago, one of the most dramatic jumps in the couple of years that we've been doing this list, James Harden. With the year that the beard had, I mean, he started out like a ball of fire in Houston, and obviously the numbers got a little bit more human from there, but just amazing the kind of the year that he had. For those of us that had a bad feeling at the time about the deal that Oklahoma City made and that it was just a little bit too financially dictated, boy, how does that look a year later? They let go of a guy who has proven that he is a franchise player and somebody that you can build around, and somebody who, because he doesn't have the injury concerns of a lot of other guys on this list, and because he is a stat sheet filler as well as a scorer, I have at the top of the third tier. But again, so many names on this list here, Ben, on the third tier, and just so many guys you can make a case for up or down, it seems like, depending on how you perceive their specific circumstances.
Right, and I think overall one of the issues with the third tier that I have is that I could make an argument some of the players in the fourth tier who were healthy, who had probably better seasons, probably deserve to be on the third tier. I would like to say, though, in terms of guys like Derrick Rose and Kevin Love, we know what they already can do. But one of the arguments that can be made against them to be up this high on the list is that they didn't really play much of this season. In terms of Rose, they didn't play the entire season. The major thing that you have to deal with when making these lists are quantifying, would you want this guy to be on your team, and would you rather prefer to have a guy who had a better season? But overall, I think just looking at this portion of the list, these are all elite guys that you would want on your team. My issue with Derrick Rose is that I think he's a great player, but I think we started to drastically overrate his abilities at times because he's put together some amazing playoff performances. But at this time, he hasn't really shown, at least to me, that he's that guy that can carry a franchise at this time.
Do you have any additional concerns as it relates to him? Because we're looking at a guy where, and this is not by all means all of it, but a decent part of his game, a significant chunk, if you want to break it down into a pie chart, would be that explosive physical ability to drive past defenders, to get into the lane. And you never know if a knee is going to be quite the same after going through something like this. I understand that these knee injuries, aside from the ones that are just really horrific and can end a career like Robert Edwards in football, but if you're not at that level, you can come back, you can basically be the same, whatever, but there's a lot of questions about that. Just as he starts to get into his late 20s and having had that, is that a concern on your part?
I mean, I think it is, and it has to be for anyone of a caliber of his talent if that is his specific goal on the basketball court. Like when Rose was coming out of Memphis, his game was to get into the paint and try and score. But the major thing for him now going forward is, will it be any mental sort of capacity? And I know a lot of people, including some, you know, very famous basketball personalities, they are questioning, is he mentally tough enough? And there's no doubt in my mind that Derrick Rose is mentally tough enough. It's just, you always have these thoughts when you don't know how someone's going to react to an injury. I always like to use the analogy, it's very similar to having that ex-girlfriend who calls you back and says, well, let's try this again. You don't really know if it was as good as it was in the previous, but there's also the thought that, well, if it was good then why can't it be good in the future?
Well, that's a very intriguing analogy, and yeah, I guess we're not really going to know until we have a body of work to judge it off of when he comes back on the court, and one could make the case that you might need the better part of a season to be able to judge that, but it was just really mind-blowing to me of the guys getting clumped up here, how many injury question marks we're talking about right now between D-Rose, Kobe, Love with the kind of season that he had, not that he's not good to go at the moment, Russell Westbrook with his injury having taken place in the playoffs. I'm really struggling to remember the last time in the NBA that we've seen a period of time like this, Ben, where you've had so many huge name guys, so many franchise players or borderline franchise players who all suffered injury-plagued seasons.
Right, and after looking at this list, I sort of went back and did my research, and I looked, and there legitimately hasn't been a time of that caliber. Like, you can make an argument, like, in the early 90s when teams started, you know, having the injury bug late in seasons, especially, I believe, if I'm correct, I think it was 91 or 92. I don't have it off the top of my brain, but there is absolutely no sort of basis for this from the past. And it's always tough to do it specifically when you do lists like this, is you have to quantify what's more important. Like I noted already, is it the player's overall talent that we already know that he can produce, or is it just what has happened in the current season? But I mean, overall, just looking at this part of the list, the only two players that I would have any sort of confidence in right now if I was starting a franchise would be James Harden and Stephen Curry. That's just honesty at that point.
That's true, because you don't have the question marks with them that you do with some of these other guys. As we look at the second tier and the top tier, the four names that are left are not going to be any surprise to anybody. And probably the top tier, the order in which they're going to be at one and two would not be a surprise. On the second tier, this sounds like something that might be a legitimate source of argument among a lot of folks here. The second tier consists solely of Carmelo Anthony, fourth, up from 12th a year ago, Dwayne Wade, third, up from 6th a year ago. And there are significant black marks against both of them right now, which for guys on the second tier, that's a mouthful, but it's kind of by process of elimination as you start to look at the guys on the third tier and why they're not at this point. Yeah, in the case of Carmelo, I gave him a big jump upward because of the kind of year that he had in New York, but I still don't see him as the kind of guy who makes other players significantly better. I had to laugh at the expectations that, the Knicks should be no worse than the Eastern Conference Finals this year. Carmelo hasn't shown that he's the kind of guy who can pick up a team and put it on its back at the NBA level. He did it in the 1 year at Syracuse. And in the case of D. Wade, you can make a case all day long for him on why he shouldn't be up there at this point based on how he's looked a lot of this postseason. But if we're doing this on the basis of if you're putting a team together for an upcoming 82-game season, which is the closest there is to an actual criterion for this thing here, you've got Wade, who I expect to be healthier next season. I think he's going to be in better shape then than he is now. He just looks like now like he's at the tail end of a very rough season. He's kind of limping along, whatever. But we've seen the flashes in the postseason here. When he is on, when he is at the top of his game, there are a few that are any better than he is. And again, just as far as, you know, being a winner, I got to give it to him over Anthony. And I say that as somebody who doesn't have any particular fondness for either guy, and that would be an understatement. But I've got it Wade and Melo 3 and 4. How do you see it, Ben?
For me, I don't disagree with having Wade and Melo at 3 and 4 because they are transcendent stars in the NBA. That's already a given. But there's an argument, and I think a lot of people would make the argument that you could say that James Harden probably had a better season than Carmelo or D. Wade. And there's even an argument you could say that, well, if Chris Paul's Clippers did a little bit better in the playoffs, he should possibly be in the third or fourth slot in the second tier. But to note, I mean, we all know Dwayne Wade, especially with his performance in Game 4, that he's arguably one of the best slashing players that we've seen in the last 15 years of the NBA. Outside of, you know, obviously number one. But it seems to me that there's not a lot in terms of outside the top two guys that are, like, can't miss, you know, build your franchise around stars, unlike in the 80s and the 90s. And in terms of Carmelo and the Knicks is that they were a team I felt early on in the season that they had the propensity to be really great at really certain times, but they have issues with trying – to right the ship near way going into the playoffs because of the way Carmelo plays. And I always like to say that Carmelo Anthony is legitimately the Susan Lucci of the NBA. He's a great player. He can do pretty much anything he wants on the basketball court, but there's just that something missing that no one can really pinpoint, whether it be killer instinct or anything along those lines. He's just not to where I think a lot of people think he should be.
No, I would agree with that because he doesn't seem to make anybody around him any better. I mean, the Knicks are where they are in terms of being a team that can make the playoffs, and particularly if they get a soft first-round opponent like the ancient Celtics can get through it, but not a team that's going to do more than that, just based on there's raw talent there. When Amari is healthy, he's still fine. You have Carmelo, who, as we've said here, borderline franchise player. You go on down the line, J.R. Smith, you look at all the raw talent that they have there. Tyson Chandler, for what he can bring you defensively, few, if any, are any better. It really kind of gives you the impression that people are a little bit hard on Mike Woodson, because I look at that and I go, you name me a coach that could do any better with those very disparate parts there that don't really fit together. Carmelo Anthony, who doesn't make anybody around him any better. Again, I think we could name a lot of coaches that would do a lot worse with that.
Right, and you know, I'm not going to state for the record that I'm in the camp of Mike Woodson. I thought he's a great NBA coach, but I think at times the level of talent he has on those teams, especially when he was coaching the Hawks and when he's currently coaching the Knicks, it just seems like he's a player's coach. But the major issue for him is that for some reason, whenever his teams get into the playoffs, even though they might be vastly superior to their opponent, they just, you know, they lay an egg, and that's just calling as you see it at that point. But the thing is, especially with the Knicks and in terms of their season, let's not lie to anyone here. They were a byproduct of the Eastern Conference. The Eastern Conference this year, outside of Miami and Indiana, wasn't any good. There weren't a lot of great teams at that point. And at some point, you have to look at their heavily reliance on three-point shooting early in the season and having a soft schedule early on, especially within their own division. It just seems that, you know, the Knicks, we never really knew how good the Knicks were at points of the season. They could look really good and then look really bad, and especially for a city like New York that it's been forever since the Knicks have won a championship. You're going back to the 70s at that point. That it doesn't, you can't really figure out what this team's identity was at certain points of the season.
Exactly. And I think it's because, again, in my estimation, the pieces don't fit together very well. I will concede to you that Mike Woodson in Atlanta, yeah, they probably didn't reach the ceiling of what they could do as a team. But for a bunch of, you know, parts that were basically just thrown in a box here without any kind of coherent plan as far as putting a team together that could possibly gel, my sense is that what Woodson's getting out of them is close to at least the ceiling of what you're going
to
get with.
And one thing I will say about Woodson, though, I will defend him, is that his team overachieved this season.
Yeah.
They overachieved.
So.
You have to give him credit for that.
Yeah. I think this is the ceiling, if not a little bit above the realistic ceiling for what you thought you could get out of the Knicks. And, again, that's a real slam on Carmelo Anthony, because, again, if he could lead the team to gel a little bit more, then they would be a team to be a caliber of at least the Eastern Conference Finals, a team that could get past Indiana without it being any kind of a sizable upset. But, again, Indiana, the quintessential team, the New York Knicks, really the antithesis of that. That's why that series shook out the way that it did. All this about Carmelo Anthony is to set up the top tier, because we've had it a little bit fatter in years past when Kobe Bryant was on it before he got hurt, when Chris Paul was on it before some of the questions came up, when Dwight Howard was on it before a lot of the questions came up with him. Instead, now the top tier is the biggest anticlimax that we have out of any of the four lists here. You don't have the foregone conclusion of what it's going to be and in what order in the NHL, in the NFL, or in Major League Baseball. But right now, you have number two, Kevin Durant, second a year ago, number one, LeBron James, number one a year ago, an absolute foregone conclusion. 100 people out of 100 would probably give you that assessment and tell you that there's a big line that's drawn underneath the two of them. And what that tells me right now is that, and maybe it makes it all the more in terms of high stakes in the summer of 2014 with LeBron James, maybe even more so than in 2010, because unless somebody else steps up to that level, we've seen in the NBA – going back to really the 1979, the start of the Magic and Bird era, that outside of the Pistons at the end of the 80s, if you're going to say that Isaiah Thomas wasn't at that level, and the 04 Pistons, coincidentally, you have to have a top-tier guy to win a championship in the league, period. You have to have at least one. So that really kind of adds high stakes to it, because if you believe that that's true, and you believe that the top tier ends right there, then over the next couple of seasons, only Oklahoma City and Miami slash wherever LeBron ends up in 2014 are going to win titles unless somebody else steps up to this level, Ben.
Right, and just, I mean, it's not, like you've already said, it's not a surprise that LeBron and Kevin Durant are 1 and 2 by any, you know, retrospective thing. The real question is, and it's a little weird to at this time because they are the two best players, but there are many other guys on the list who have championship rings, and essentially both LeBron and Durant have combined for one out of about four finals performances between them. And after a while, you just have to consider, like, are these guys really, really great players, or are they the byproduct of, well, you know, and we can use the Magic and Bird era as a template for that. Are they really good players, or is just the rest of the league not up to their potential? There's no argument that LeBron James is the best player, but in terms of his talent, I would have at least expected for him to have multiple championship rings by this point.
I agree with that. And the thing that really, in my mind, kind of defines him the most in terms of what we've seen out of him, and the final series this year against San Antonio fits right along with that, is people look at that and they consider him to be disappointing in terms of the number of rings, enigmatic in terms of his big game performances versus disappearances. And again, as a Cavs fan, I personally will never forget Game 5 of the 2010 Eastern Conference semifinals against Boston. Guys like Jordan didn't have games like that. They might have had games that were mild disappointments, but not laying the egg that badly on a big stage. The thing about LeBron that's interesting is you take that game where he scored the last, what was it, 27 or whatever in a row against Detroit in the 07 Eastern Conference Finals. He can have a game that's as great as the greatest game Jordan ever put up, which is something that you can't say about a lot of the other guys on this list. But there will be other games where he will go the other way. He'll lay a bigger egg than, say, a Magic Johnson ever did or some of these other guys. So that's what's really, again, that enigmatic would be the word, that he can have a game that's better than just about any of the guys on the NBA top all-time list, if you're looking at top 5, top 10, or whatever. He could play as great as their greatest game ever was. It's just irregular when it comes about.
And I greatly agree with that sentiment. My major thing with LeBron James is that he has the ability to turn it on and off. And I think unfairly in our social media, you know, hyper-instant world that we live in, I think at times we unfairly judge LeBron just because of what he's gone through over his career. And I think the Jordan comparisons, we already have mostly determined that those have been put out to pasture. But one of the arguments and examples I like to use after a while in regards to LeBron James and Michael Jordan is that you're really comparing someone to like the top of all time. And when you're comparing someone to the top of all time, they're never going to live up to the expectation. You're not going to take some guy off the street who wants to be an actor and then turn him into a George Clooney overnight. That just doesn't happen in this day and age. It just seems to me that at times LeBron James has to switch. He can turn it on and off. Specifically in these finals, if you look at Game 3, he was non-existent. He was sort of turning into that Magic Johnson distributor role. And then Game 4, he turned into the Jordan role of scoring 33 points. But the major thing with LeBron James at this point, and his legacy is going to be determinant at the end of this, he's going to need to win 3 or 4 rings to validate his career at some point.
Absolutely, because the thing about him is, I think the biggest defining factor in terms of his game is that he's this weird test tube amalgam of some of the greatest players ever. The obvious point of comparison, because he's such a great distributor, especially for a guy of his size, would be Magic Johnson. He's Jordan-esque in some ways, obviously as far as his ability to drive, penetrate, occasionally shoot. In the last 2 years, he's developed some much-needed mailman Malone, because he's a guy who can do a lot of damage down on the blocks. Sadly enough, for me and for other Cavs fans, didn't choose to develop that part of his game while he was in Cleveland. He was still one of the very, very best even without that. But you look at the top tier, you look at him, and you look at Durant, and in my mind, what Durant did in the playoffs, and it's a small sample size, but what he did without Westbrook, that shows you why we rate him significantly over Carmelo Anthony as far as putting him on another tier, because Oklahoma City, they were dead men walking when Russ Westbrook went down. We know this. But what Durant did, how heroic he was in terms of trying to make up the assists, and obviously the punchline is with Russell Westbrook, well, how many assists are there to make up the way that he shoots the ball? But regardless, the way that Durant tried to fill those shoes, and I think succeeded, because they put up as great of an effort as they possibly could have against the Memphis team that was just going to absolutely stifle them at that part. Carmelo Anthony can't do what Durant did. And if it was Carmelo Anthony there, they would have lost and they would have just looked worse doing it. And you could say, okay, a loss is a loss. But Durant stepped into the breach and basically did as much as anybody possibly could under the circumstances. And I think we have a hard time picturing Carmelo doing the same thing under those exact same circumstances.
Right. There is also an argument to be made that you could say that Kevin Durant is a better overall player than LeBron James. You could even rank him higher than LeBron on this list and make him number one because of just his overall skill set. But the problem is, and LeBron has the same exact issue too, is that there are times where they feel where like Durant and LeBron don't exactly have this killer instinct that they need to close down games at certain points. And I know it sounds weird to say that, but just looking at the body of work, Durant in the playoffs outside of that finals appearance, you know, there have been times where I felt that he would need to step up more and carry more of the role. But it seems like, and I don't know if it's a byproduct of his times, is that the upper elite crust of players outside of maybe Kobe Bryant don't necessarily have that killer instinct, that mentality that guys like Jordan or Gary Payton or Karl Malone had at periods of time in their career. And at some point, you have to wonder, is that necessarily because of how we portray them now, or is it because that's just the case?
That's a great point, because I'm looking at the top couple of tiers here, and I'm trying to use the word fierce in my head here, like who would I apply it to outside of Kobe? And yeah.
And another guy, we could say Chris Paul, too. To make an argument on Chris Paul's defense,
yeah.
I think you could also say that he is that guy. And I think the major issue with us is that since the Clippers had a crappy playoff run, we're going to downgrade him a little bit because of that.
Right. And I'm looking at this, and Parker and Duncan, I mean, they're kind of like Tom Landry. I mean, Tom Landry was fierce, but, you know, he didn't wear it on his chest necessarily. So it's the same. They're as fierce as Kobe. You couldn't make the case that they're not. But it doesn't come to mind, maybe because he's more expressively fierce, if you want to use that phrase. But that's a great point to wrap this on, is to take a look and to see, you know, as far as the state of the game and how these guys fit. This list, of course, can be seen at the FBH Lounge multimedia magazine, the FBHLounge.blogspot.com, as well as in the upcoming, very soon, Pro Hoops Draftology 2013. Our look at the 2013. NBA draft. Of course, there is always great basketball coverage wall-to-wall over at that NBALotteryPick.com. Ben, I know that with this now becoming your primary focus as far as what you've been working on professionally, that everything has just gone to another level over there, and looking forward to seeing many more great things from the site, my man.
Oh, and I appreciate being on with you, Rick. And this, you know, this top 30 list, it's not easy, and I always tell people that this list is more difficult than other sports because you have so many guys placed at certain different levels. And to be honest, you can make an argument for anyone on this list to be number one at some point.
Sure, sure. You know, it depending on what the sample size is and what we're looking at. But, yeah, it's a snapshot in time, and in order to be able to get the great segments out of it that I knew we could, it's incumbent upon getting somebody to come in and do some great analysis on this, as you did. Thank you so much, Ben, and look forward to having you on again sometime soon.
All right, thank you, Rick. You have a good rest of your weekend.
Thank you, pal. Take care, and thank you all for tuning in to FBH Lounge, mini episode number 274.